What's up, everybody? It's John. Thank you so much for downloading the Rock Tape Podcast. So happy that you're here with us this week. This week, I've got Brent Brookbush of the Brookbush Institute with me. We have a great conversation about things we need to pay attention to when looking at research. We talk a lot about research myths that are out there. And Brent is always an enlightening conversation because he knows so much about research. He does so much reading on a number of different topics as it relates to musculoskeletal health. And he really does a good job of explaining to us as the listener what we should really make sure we don't do when we're looking at research and some of the things that we should be doing when we're looking at research as well. If you know Brookbush, you know of the Brookbush Institute, and I definitely have to promote that because this is something that I use myself. He is not a sponsor of the podcast, so I am speaking as a user of the brookbushinstitute.com. This membership site has 150 plus courses designed for engagement, flexibility, and convenience. This is like the Netflix of continuing ed. There's a desktop and a mobile app. You sign on with your membership and you can take courses on demand as you see fit, whichever course you like. And then if you go through the accreditation process and taking those tests to test out, you earn CEUs that will then apply to the different certifications that Brookbush has on the website, including certified personal trainers, human movement specialists, and integrative manual therapist certification. I cannot recommend this site enough. This is a fantastic thing. I personally use this in one of my classes with my students because it has been extremely helpful having the online content. So without any further ado, let's get to my conversation with Brent. So good stuff. I've got Brent Brookbush here. Brent, my good friend, is the founder, CEO, president, I don't actually know what your true title is, of the Brookbush Institute. Brent, thank you for being here, man. It's good to see you again.
It's good to see you again. Love getting on and talking with you about all these wonderfully intense issues that we get into.
Yeah, the intense is a good term. I think contentious might also be a good term for it too. But you know, one thing I appreciate about you is you put it out there. I'm one of those people is like, I think we can have a discussion, we can have disagreeing opinions, but not get in each other's face about it. You know what I mean? So I do enjoy
over podcast. Right? What's up? We can't really get in each other's face via podcast. Yeah. So we're safe.
True, yeah. Well, but you know how it is on social media is the backlash and stuff like that. It's like, hey, if you don't agree with me, that's fine. But here's what I have. Here's what you have. And you do a great job. You know, I love your posts that you have on Instagram talking about some of the issues that you see within research and then people, how they use that research. So we've got, you know, you gave me a great list of different things that we can talk about. I mean, I don't even know where to start really with that, but I think one of the great things is what we were just talking about as we started this off is this idea of like excuse-driven therapy. Can you kind of define that term for everybody listening?
Yeah, this will probably make more sense as we get through the entire podcast. So as we label all of these misinterpretations of research and these fallacies in the interpretation of research, what is actually driving this misinterpretation? What is actually driving these controversies? And I think what I find is that it's being driven by what I call the excuse-driven therapist or the complacent therapist. They're basically looking for a reason to dismiss anything that they don't currently know or are not comfortable with, right? We see this with like people who are very anti-manual therapy. Mm-hmm. Well, look, manual therapy does take practice. It is a skill. You are probably going to have to go to some additional educational workshops or take some additional courses to really learn how to use that tool effectively. But you get these new grads who come out, they're a little arrogant, a little cocky, some of them, and they go, well, I can't make manual therapy work right now, so it must suck. Boom, here's my excuse. Manual therapy sucks, right? Mm-hmm. And we can just kind of go down that path of like anything you want to talk about. Well, I don't like dry needling. It's like, well, why don't you like dry needling? Is it because you don't know how to do it? Or is it because the research actually shows something that we shouldn't be using it for, which actually isn't the case with dry needling. Dry needling is very well supported.
Right.
But, you know, I think that whole idea of like, if I don't know it or I'm not comfortable with it, it must be wrong, is where a lot of these controversies come up, especially on social media, which we know is the haterverse and controversy sells, and it is what it is.
I think cesspool might be good.
Yeah, depending on which one we're talking, which platform we're talking about.
Yeah, which platform we're talking about. Yeah. And I like the term because it kind of makes sense in my mind when I start to think about different situations that I've been put in there. And I'll fully admit when I came out, there were certain things that I didn't do that I think, looking back on it, I probably dismissed it. I was quick to probably, crap on a few things because I didn't know about it, or maybe it at first seemed kooky or it seemed weird or something like that. And I think the message to drive home is that we really should be looking at this research to understand whether something or method is good, bad, whatever you want to call it. So what you get a lot of is something you talk about a lot is people will dismiss research almost in like a cherry picking way. They start to cherry pick research in an effort to not even try to prove, hey, this does work, to prove that, oh no, see, this does not work. So they start to cherry pick that research. How do you think that starts to come about?
Yeah, I mean, the point we've made on some of our posts, and I think that you're getting at is, I think when people think about cherry picking, they think about supporting a point with only a couple of studies. Right? So they're selecting, they're picking the cherries that they like and only putting those forward. But the truth of the matter is dismissing research is also cherry picking, right? So just because you didn't select one, but you dismissed everything, it's still the same thing. You're ending up with this narrow body of evidence that only supports your conclusion, right?
Right.
Your confirmation bias. So I think what's important to remember is when people go about this dismissing of research, if your critique cannot be systematized and applied to both sides of an argument, it's likely arbitrary and doesn't matter. I can go into any study and find something I don't like.
Right.
But that doesn't matter. Because at the end of the day, all research is showing us is a data point. And we need to accept that data point at face value for exactly what it is. We're not trying to generalize it. We're not trying to, unless we're trying to create a bigger argument or a bigger conclusion. But for the research study itself, it's bad practice to dismiss it altogether. It would be much better just to go, okay, this research study is saying this with this experiment on this population. Let's take that one point and put it over here.
Right.
And that's all it is.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, everybody online is like, well, that research sucks because of, and it's like, okay, can you do that to the research study on your side? Right. I think the other part that comes into this is there's a fallacy called the default. I think it's like default position fallacy, which is too many people assume that because they've proved you wrong, that proves them right. Mm. That's not the case. Every position you've taken has to have its own evidence.
Right.
Right. So if I say, for example, cervical manipulations are effective for cervical pain, and I present a study and they go, that study's bullshit. You don't know what you're talking about. You have no idea that cervical manipulations are effective for this population. Okay. Well, wait a second. What evidence do you have? Right. So what are you saying? And if you make them define their position, usually their arguments fall apart. Or it's like they don't have to necessarily take the negative position, but let's say they take, instead of like cervical manipulations don't work, right, which would be a little harder to prove, they take the position that exercise is better. Okay, we'll prove that.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, their whole argument falls apart because actually the research does not show that exercise is more effective than cervical manipulations.
Yeah.
Right? Or it shows, which this is actually true, cervical manipulation and exercise together is actually the most effective means of moving forward.
I was just going to say that's what most studies tend to show. That's a generalization, but most people would know that, that plus exercise, all that combination of therapy is more effective than one individually too. Do you think that this came out of the idea of people just wanting to try to prove their methods correct? And even The idea of maybe I think misusing research might be a way to say it is like, I'm going to look for research and I want it to prove absolutely this. And instead they're not taking it as that data point is this study was done on this population, for this reason with this method and only seeing it for what it is. They're taking it as this study all by itself proves my point. Therefore I'm going to go all in with that.
Yeah, I mean, you actually started gearing towards a point that's really important in the scientific method that does not get talked about enough, which is when we look at research, we shouldn't be trying to prove our conclusions.
Right.
We should be looking to gather all of our research and then come to a conclusion based on the research. Like, those two things are backwards. Mm-hmm. Right. So a lot of people out there are trying to support their opinion or support their confirmation bias or support their conclusions, whatever we want to call it, with the research that they found, as opposed to doing the really hard work of, okay, I'm going to gather all of the research on this topic, let's say cervical manipulations. And based on all of this research, now I'm going to come to a nuanced conclusion, an appropriately detailed conclusion that gives me a good idea of what best practice for cervical manipulations actually is. And it might be that cervical manipulations suck, but I'm not going to make that decision until I've looked at all of the research.
Right. That's a good question. I don't think it has a perfect answer for it, but it's a question that might come up is, you know, you say this, you know, one of your taglines for your website is, if it doesn't have a bibliography, you know, it's not worth reading. So, yeah. How much should we look at? Like, is there a good, like, hey, you should look at this many studies. You should look at, you know, this many studies for, this many studies against. Is there some, could you put a number to that?
Okay, so the for and against thing we're going to come back to is another myth that needs to be busted. There is no for and against.
Okay.
Data is data. If you think research contradicts itself, mm-hmm. you need to look harder, right? Like, research usually doesn't contradict other research.
Okay.
We'll get into that later in the podcast. How many studies you should look at. Now, this is where I have extreme empathy for my colleagues. I mean, you know that, like, I'm not a jerk. Like, I'm not trying to prove people wrong. It's not, you know, I'm just trying to help any way I can. And I actually, and I've said this on several podcasts, think there are parts of the evidence-based movement that are a joke.
Okay.
And one of the big parts of the evidence-based movement that is a joke is that somehow, as a practitioner, you're going to be able to be 100% based on research.
Right.
The truth is that until you look at all of the research, you cannot come to the most refined or the most optimal conclusion possible. And when we're talking about certain modalities, that's hundreds of studies.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, how many do you pick? And it's like, there's no good answer to that question. Because you could say something like, well, if we could, like, try to look at it mathematically. Let's say that there's a body of research that's 375 studies. How many randomly selected studies will we have to pick to think that our effect direction would be fairly accurate, right? And so we could probably take a sample size. We could treat it like research of research, right?
Right.
And this is what some meta-analysis try to do. But the problem with that is usually when you do something like that, you miss all of the nuance. Because most research studies are just not identical. You know, for example, I keep coming back to cervical manipulation just so we kind of have a theme here. Right. But cervical manipulation, you might be looking at studies and they might be looking at, like, effects, right? Like some patho-excitatory effects, like the effects on the sympathetic nervous system. And you realize that some studies are on symptomatic individuals and some studies are on asymptomatic individuals, right? Some are using cardiovascular measures of sympatho-excitatory effects and others are using skin conductance measures. Can't talk all of a sudden. And all of that little stuff starts building a story, I guess you could say, right? Starts building a conclusion. So if I randomly took three of those studies on the sympatho-excitatory effects of the cervical spine, chances are I'm going to see that it has sympatho-excitatory effects, but it's going to be a little all over the map. you know, I'm going to have one study that's on asymptomatic individuals that showed heart rate variability, one that was on symptomatic individuals that didn't show heart rate variability, and another one that was working on skin conductance in an RCT that had both symptomatic and asymptomatic individuals. And then I go, what are my conclusions? And right? Like, it's like all over. But meanwhile, you know, somebody went into that going, well, I was just looking for cervical manipulation research.
Right.
So the question of how much should you look at is, you kind of have to go back to what we said before. We talk about if it doesn't have a bibliography, it's not worth studying, right? So it is important that you're getting your information in general as a practitioner from highly research supported materials. You know, now you can do your fun reading for stuff that's not research supported, but when you're studying, you need to really look for those professionals who are geeks and do the lit reviews and really get into the nitty gritty so that you can get a good reasonable conclusion. As far as how many research studies you should read, you're much better off creating a practice of reading research on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Right? Than trying to like tackle a problem. Now, if you wanted to take your regular reading up a notch, challenge yourself to do a lit review. It doesn't ever have to be published.
Sure.
You could just do an annotated bibliography and come to some conclusions, like almost like a very like casual blog post you're creating. That'll definitely up your comprehension and retention. But I can't, there is no good answer for that question of like, how many research studies should I read? It's like, well,
right. Yeah, I thought so. I mean,
we're talking about manipulations. There's thousands of studies,
sure.
Right? Well, like
the way you said it before too is, you know, use the example of someone saying, well, I was just looking for research on cervical manipulations. Isn't that a little bit incomplete? If that's like how, oh, I want to look at what the research says about cervical manipulations. What about cervical manipulations? You know, I feel like where some people go into it, I know I've done it myself, is just like, hey, let me go to Google Scholar and just type something in and see what studies come up. And then I'm just arbitrarily picking stuff and I don't actually have a focus to it. So it sounds like, you know, that's a big thing that I think people need to do is complete that sentence. I'm looking for this for the purposes of this.
And, but with that being said, we have to be careful we don't do what we were talking about before, which is cervical manipulations, and then we do something stupid like are not effective.
Right.
Right? Now you've programmed your bias into your search, and now you've just gone back to cherry picking research
okay.
that supports a particular conclusion. And this is, like I said, where I have a lot of empathy for my colleagues, because this idea of evidence-based practice was not well thought out. Right? Like it just wasn't. At the end of the day, the operationalizing of evidence-based practice was not well thought out.
Sure.
So yes, you have to get a little bit more in detail, but you have to be very careful that in that detail, you're not baking the question. You're not baking in the answer that you want.
Right. And that might take us into what you were saying before, is the idea of looking for and against, which is you said before, doesn't really exist. So talk a little bit about that. I know a lot of people that go into that. Again, I'll say that I'm more than likely guilty looking for that, as I want to see how good it is for this or how bad it is for that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think it's looking at the problem the wrong way, right? Mm-hmm. It's just data.
Yeah.
Right? An experiment is just giving you data. So do you really think that if experiments are done in an objective way, that they're going to keep spitting out contradictory results?
Good point.
They shouldn't, right? Like if we're repeating these experiments over and over again, assuming that we were using the same variables, like they should be spitting out the same data. Now, what happens in research, of course, is we end up not having identical variables, which is why we get different answers. The truth is, though, that's different answers to different questions. Where people stop and they don't think hard enough is, what you really should be thinking to yourself is, what is the conclusion that would make all of these research outputs happen? Right? So, you know, back to cervical manipulations. Well, we might find that cervical manipulations help with range of motion in symptomatic individuals. And then you look at another individual, another study, and it says is not helpful for range of motion. And you look into it and it says asymptomatic individuals, right, is who they used in their participant pool. Well, now we have nuance. We don't have contradicting studies. We have nuance. We have cervical manipulations are likely to help for range of motion in individuals who are symptomatic, right? That's what we can say. And then maybe the next study comes along and it's like, all right, well, upper cervical, or let's say lower cervical manipulations were ineffective for cervicogenic headache. Okay. And then we get another one that says cervical manipulations are good for cervicogenic headache. And we start thinking to yourself, well, okay, we know that it helps range of motion in symptomatic individuals. Both of these populations are symptomatic, but we're starting to see a trend now that maybe your manipulation should probably occur closer to where the symptoms are. Like lower cervical manipulations may not be as effective as upper cervical manipulations for cervicogenic headache, which we know is usually upper cervical spine dysfunction driven. Mm-hmm. So like, every time you add another study, you're just adding a little bit more nuance. These things don't contradict each other.
Yeah.
But it takes, you have to think. You have to actually use this giant thing on your shoulders that allows you to crunch these more complicated problems.
You mean, wait, I have to think about it. Oh, geez. But that's what I look for the research, right? It just tells me what I need to believe, right?
No. Henry Ford actually has a really funny quote. Evidently, he was a funny guy. The guy who invented the Model T.
Yeah.
Car, right? And he said, the hardest work you will ever do is think. Which is why you see so few people doing it. It's like, it's kind of sad and true. And it's,
no, but you're right. That's perfect. It's sad and true. It's sad, but true, you know? So now Metallica is going to be stuck in my head, which I'm okay with. But, it's true of research. I think it's, I don't know how it came to be. This movement of evidence-based, just it turned, and I don't know when it happened, but it turned into the idea of just like my study is better than your study. Your study, you know, disproves this. And it goes back to what you were saying, I think, about cherry picking a little bit, is people just trying to, you know, dismiss things because one particular study says that, and they're not taking those nuance and those data points as a whole and trying to come with a culminating conclusion, maybe is a way to say it, is like, what is all of the evidence trending towards? You know, it's not telling, does it tell us this? Well, maybe it's not that definitive. Maybe it's trending towards, and I like the term that you use there.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about the fact that number one, research is probabilities. There is no binary.
Yeah.
There is no yes, no. It's all statistical inference. So, I mean, that's another point that we could talk about where people make that mistake. I think, you know, to the points we've made up to this point and the excuse-driven therapist that I was talking about before, we've learned that confirmation bias is almost innate, right? Like, this is something we all have to fight against. We've seen this with what happened with social media over the last 6-7 years, right? Mm-hmm. People getting fed what they want to hear, which strengthens their beliefs. And it doesn't matter what your political beliefs are. I'm not trying to get into a political argument here, but what we saw was this huge division in the country. People are more apart than they've ever been. And it's because if you're on one side, that's all the information you're getting supports that. And if you're on the other side, that's all the information you get. And the overlap is very little. Now, the scientific method is supposed to protect us from our own biases. And so when we talk about, like, every time I get on one of these podcasts, every time we get on online, like, I'm like, this isn't about, you know, the Brookbush Institute, as I've mentioned before, it was named after me by accident, right? This isn't Brookbush's opinion on stuff Institute,
right?
Brookbush came out of the fact that the company started with my social media pages and eventually developed into an education platform. But what we go back to internally is like, you have to look at the scientific method. You have to check your biases at the door. You have to try to come up with some way of systematizing and objectively coming to conclusions. We have to like go, okay, wait a second. You know, how do we get around this thing That is all of our innate confirmation bias. Now, the way we do that at the Brookbush Institute is, of course, all of our courses are built on these massive, comprehensive, systematic reviews.
Extremely thorough.
Yeah. So we don't come to conclusions outright. We build our reviews and then present the conclusions. It's, you know, we very much here look at it as a service we provide, right? Like this, we're doing the hard work for you guys in a lot of the cases of doing the systematic reviews so that hopefully you can get into us and go, okay, what is the Brookbush Institute? How is this summarized real quick? So at least I can get the crib sheet.
Right.
And then of course you guys can go into the systematic review. And of course the bibliographies are there if you really just want to read all the research. It's all there for you, but at least we give you the crib notes at top so you can keep practicing. Cause if you had to stop practicing until you read all the research, I still wouldn't be practicing. And I've read more research than just about anybody else I know. So,
well, that's a good point too, is, you know, you mentioned it earlier, and there's the other side of the coin is people, they have to have all the research has to be looked at. And then there's people who don't want to look at any of the research. And it's like, meet us in the middle. You're not going to be able to do, you shouldn't do no research, obviously, and you can't read everything that's going to be out there. And this kind of leads me into the next point is you mentioned before, or in a previous post, I believe, new not being better. And one of the things you mentioned in the post is the idea that people will insist on, this study's too old. You can't, you know, you can't use this study anymore, that kind of thing. But if you're building this bibliography, if you're looking at these nuance points, these data points, and you're coming to that ultimate, you know, conclusion where the trends go, you have to look at the older research. Where did it come from the idea of, like, if it's older than a few years, it's not worth it?
I'm going to take a wild guess, and I'm sorry to go against my colleagues here as a rogue professor myself. This is poor professorship. This okay. is poor teaching. Through and through, the amount of stories I get with, my professor told me I was only allowed to use research studies in the last 10 years, and my professor told me that, you know, if I can't find, if the research doesn't agree, go with the newer research study. This is false. It's called argumentum ad noventum, right? It's appeal to novelty. Right? Appeal to newness. And you think about it, like, let's take this out of our realm for a second. Nobody is questioning the theory of relativity. Right? When was the theory of relativity published?
I should know.
1930s.
The 30s, yeah.
Right? So it might have been earlier than that, actually.
I was going to say the 20s, but I couldn't back it up, so.
Yeah, I might have a couple dates. I have a few dates going around in my head, but with that being said, look back up, you know, when Einstein published that paper, nobody's arguing with that. Now, if you published a paper on relativistic physics, right now, are you more accurate than Einstein was?
Not automatically, like, because you published it new, no.
Exactly, right? So this whole idea that new is just better, it doesn't make any sense. We could also go to things like the sliding filament theory. We could also go to things like the synaptic model of the nervous system. These things happened in the early part, you know, like before 1950. Nobody's going, well, I can publish right now on my blog, right? And I'm more right because I just published it right now.
Right.
Let's take this another step. Let's bust this myth up again. Okay, so the last 10 years. This is the common one. Well, if the research hasn't happened the last 5 years or 10 years, what happened 10 years ago that so fundamentally changed research methods that all previous research was left just going, oh, we're idiots?
Yeah.
You tell me what happened. Like, this is an argument I've gotten in before. Like, what happened in 2010 that just cut off everything before it?
Yeah. Well, right? And then it's a sliding scale too. So, like, next year, does that mean anything before 2011? And then the year after that is 2012. It's like, that's a sliding scale. You're basically just taking this section of time and you're just moving it over.
I remember, yeah. I mean, what it really comes down to, right, is like, if research truly contradicts, which usually it does not, and you're saying that the new study is better, it's actually not the newness that has to make it better. What would have to make it better is an actual something, like a increase in the technology available or a new statistical tool being used, which new statistical tools do not come around that often.
Right.
You know, or some new research method or some, you know, more sophisticated methodology or research design. Right. I think one of the favorite things people do is they like to bust up the Richardson, Hodges, and Hides research with the transverse abdominis stuff. Right. Hmm. And if you go back and look at that research, man, that research was really well done. We're talking fine wire, right? EMG, like they actually used ultrasound to place, you know, these EMG things inside the muscle.
And you're referencing the study about the transverse abdominis activation milliseconds before limb movement, right?
Yeah. And actually, it's dozens of studies. That's the other thing that we have to think about. And it's randomized control trials.
Right.
Right? And then people will bash it because, and usually what they'll cite, I'm not kidding here, is something relatively recent that is using a quasi-experimental design with surface electrodes and no control group. And you go, wait a second. Which one of these methodologies is much more thorough?
Right.
Right? Like you're not, these are not equally done research studies. And, but just because this one's new, you want to use it? No, no, it doesn't work that way. Now, in reality, when I've looked at that, the transverse abdominis research, it does not contradict. It's a lot more nuanced, but it doesn't actually contradict. But that is a good example of where people need to go, okay, you need to actually look at the research studies and tell me a good reason why we should dismiss. And take my opinion for what it is. You know, I've now done over 100 of these systematic reviews. I can tell you the difference between our research today and almost going back into the 1970s is almost nothing. There's no difference in research methodologies. There's no difference in statistics used. And people go, well, what about technology? We don't have access to that technology. I mean, you can bring up functional MRIs and you can bring up some of the, it's expensive and most research does not use it.
Yeah.
It is very rare that you see research use these very expensive measurement tools. It just doesn't happen. Most people are still using surface EMG and like goniometry and outcome questionnaires and all of the same stuff we've been using for decades. It's not until you get at least pre-1980 and probably pre-1960 before you start looking at things and going, okay, I need to pay a little closer attention to this research study because the peer review process wasn't quite as diligent as it is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a comforting thought too, because, you know, sometimes when you, as a teacher myself, you know, trying to choose an appropriate textbook, you know, there are great textbooks that are 10 years old and they haven't necessarily come out with a new edition or anything like that. And in the back of your mind, you're always like, oh, geez,
there's new textbooks that suck. I saw a textbook the other day that somebody hit me with, written by a very popular educator at the time. It was the most cherry-picked, like, catastrophic storytelling, horribly unacademic thing I have read in a long time, to the point where, like, you know, there's every once in a while, very rarely, but every once in a while I read a paper where I go, well, this is interesting. This person has a really different view. I hope they've found some research that I couldn't find, which we know, you know, one of the problems with research is synonyms. Okay. So people use so many different words and different labels for things that sometimes it's hard to find all of the studies on a particular topic.
Sure.
And so I'll look at something like that and I'll go, man, I hope this like person like gets me into some stuff that I didn't even know that synonym. I didn't know that label. I didn't know to look for that stuff. And I'll get in and just be like, seriously? Like, do you think it's okay to make a statement like, you know, what was one of it? Yeah, there was a statement made like we're in a pain, an orthopedic pain epidemic, and physical therapy has never, you know, isn't being shown effective. And then I look at the citation on this sentence, and the person's citing themselves in a previous paper they wrote. And I'm like, that is unprofessional. That is academically dishonest, mm-hmm. right? That references should only be referencing original citations, and you should only be referencing the original data, not the author's opinion, right? Because when you write a sentence with a citation at the end of it, what the reader thinks is, oh, this sentence is supported. Mm-hmm. And you're going to use yourself as a citation. So to
It'd
your
be
point,
like
sorry,
walking around just talking about everything, and then like you have like a little citation number like just attached to your glasses just right over here, and yeah. It's like everything I'm saying is cited by me.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little that's academic dishonesty as far as I'm concerned. But yeah to your point, man, of like I've seen textbooks 10 years old. I mean, Trevelyan Simmons is still one of the best anatomy textbooks out there. Right. They did such a good, thorough job of explaining anatomy. And has trigger point research continued to grow? Sure. That doesn't necessarily mean that something published in 1990 is wrong, though. There's just more information to add on top of that. I think actually, I mean, Trevelyan Simmons has been updated since then. But that's a good example, though. Gray's Anatomy, for the most part, right, has been right for a very long time. Like, you know, these are textbooks that work well. And then, like we said, you can have a textbook that's written by somebody who's very biased. And just because they're using new research, it's actually way more inaccurate.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. And again, too, the idea that there's a time frame, that in and of itself just seems wrong to me, because it's always going to change. The next year, it's going to change. You're going to start to, like, it makes it sound like you have to now eliminate certain research after the year passes. That's also kind of cherry picking, if you will, too, right?
It is absolutely a type of cherry picking. That's another one of those fallacies to try to dismiss research, and it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, the other thing that I, because a lot of this stuff is generated by new grads, I'm sorry, it's true. Like, they're arrogant, they get out of school, they think they know it all. And you know, the thing I have to remind them is, do you really think you're the first intelligent generation? Do you really think you're the first smart person to ever graduate?
Right?
Like, the two people who are on this podcast right now, we're a little older now, right? Like, what, we were idiots? And the new grads now are smart? Like, how did that happen? And then, like, let's think about some of our, you know, the big figures in our practice. Like, we didn't get here by accident.
No.
Right? Like, you can't look at, like, Syriacs, right? You know, orthopedic evaluation, 100 years old, and go, Syriacs was an idiot. Are you kidding?
Right?
Syriacs had more information to give in two textbooks than some new grad has.
Right.
Like, are you kidding? Yeah. And that was 100 years ago. And of course, you know, the Sherrington, right? We know Sherrington's law of reciprocal inhibition. You know, Sherrington, it created the synaptic model, or he hypothesized the synaptic model of the nervous system, and won a prize for that, right? Like, that was one of the scientific prizes awarded for that year, right? Einstein and this guy, and that was in the 1930s, right?
What, Sherrington's so he was Nobel? Idiot too?
Huh?
Sherrington's Nobel?
Yeah.
Was it I think when he won it in the 30s, a lot of his theories came out like the aughts and the tens, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, you look back and it's like, there's so many smart people in our history. Like, who the heck do you think you are? You know, people who, again, bash Richardson, Hodges, and Hyde. And you're like,
yeah,
because they're a little older than you. And they've published a lot more than you. I don't see how you are all of a sudden smarter than they are. And we could do this, of course, with everything. I mean, there's books on, you know, Stanley Parris and like, Maitland and I don't know, start rattling off names. Like, there's all these people who've spent their lives trying to make this practice better. Yeah. But no, you new grad, you're the smartest dude to ever walk the earth. Go ahead and dismiss everybody before you.
The weirdest thing is it's taken as an affront. It's like, oh, the old guy doing this. We have better technology and newer research. And they almost take it like that old guy was doing all of this to screw me 100 years later. It's like, what the? What are you talking about? Sherrington had it out for me all the way back then.
That's right. Yonda, Sarmon, screw you guys. I see the game you're playing.
Caught on to you.
Yeah, can you imagine? That would be, you want to talk about smart. If somebody could think that far ahead and have the foresight to screw somebody after they're dead.
That's actually brilliant.
There's some brilliance in there. But yeah, man, a little humility goes a long way.
Yes.
I'm always humble to the scientific method. And there are people that I disagree with who came before me. But there's a difference between having an intellectual disagreement and the utmost respect and dismissing somebody and being disrespectful about it. And I think we have to keep that in mind too. Like, you know, Yonda is, you know, I have these predictive models of postural dysfunction, and posture is this big thing right now, a lot of controversy around it, which there shouldn't be, but that's a whole different discussion. Now, based on where we're at, are my predictive models of postural dysfunction different than Yonda's models, like upper cross syndrome, lower cross syndrome, pronation distortion? Yes, of course. But here's the thing. Yonda's like Darwin for that stuff, right? Like, he all of a sudden looked at the human body and went, wait a second, these compensation patterns are happening in patterns, mm-hmm. and they're predictable. It doesn't matter what I come up with after that point, that's the genesis.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you can't not respect that.
No, yeah.
Like, that's I have beyond admiration for Yonda, even though I know certain points of his techniques or certain points of his books were not as accurate as we are now.
Sure.
You know, just taking like a stance like that would be so much more easier to stomach than like listening to some of these guys be like, that was total bullshit.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, I have a hard time believing anything was total bullshit. I mean, assuming that it was backed by some research and got somewhat popular. I mean, people were using it probably because it was at least moderately effective or
mildly
effective.
I totally agree with that. Is something complete BS? I don't know. You know, like, then you have to go through the process of trying to prove its complete BS-ness. So it's like, now we have to go through this cycle all over again too, right?
Yeah. So weird.
It's very weird. And I think it's just dismissing the idea of we're all still trying to learn. So why would I'll just say it. You know, I totally agree with you because, yes, I see it with new grads as well too. I don't know why or how, but students for some reason, you know, I almost even say students, like, when in the thick of it, they should be the ones on top of this because they're really into it. They're getting in. They have to study. They have to prepare for tests and stuff like that. But they are showing a lot of these biases that are going on. And I don't really know where that comes from. And I don't know if it's, we mentioned a little bit before, like, there could be laziness to it. There could be the idea of that confirmation bias. I just want my thing to kind of be proven. I don't really know where it comes from, but I hear this a lot, is the idea of busy work. And it's like, oh, well, it's just busy work or something like that. And I take that almost to this conversation as somebody's like, you know, I'm being told to just do this. It has no purpose. There's no point or anything like that. It's almost like people do this with research too. It's like, oh, this research study was just something. Somebody had to publish something. You know, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't prove the point I wanted to prove anyway. So it's just kind of chalk it up to that busy work category or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this stuff gets, you're actually starting to tip off on some complicated stuff that I've been trying to teach on a little bit more, and somehow I'm going to integrate into a class. But I ran into this problem when I was trying to figure out what a comprehensive education platform would look like. Hmm. Right. When you start thinking about what a comprehensive education platform would look like, you can't say it teaches everything, because that would essentially generate an infinite amount of work, and there's no way for me to manage that. So I started going, okay, so what should I be teaching? And you go, okay, well, we should be teaching the most effective techniques. Well, what are the most effective techniques based on? Well, they're going to have an impact on assessment. Well, what type of assessment? It's going to have to be some sort of objectively measured assessment, because we know subjective measures are not particularly reliable. Well, okay, so now we have this loop between, okay, this assessment implies that this technique should be done. Well, how are we going to test its effectiveness? Well, with this assessment. So all of a sudden we create this circular logic loop, which we have to now get out of. So then you go, okay, well, how do we choose assessments? And then you end up in this thing with predictive modeling, right? Which is where the predictive models of dysfunction come from. And what are those predictive models based on? Well, they're based on data, which is like the systematic reviews. And what you end up with is essentially an information science problem, right? So we end up with, how do we sort, how do we label, and how do we prioritize activity? And you have to start thinking way more mathematically, way more programmatically. Like computer programmers are great examples for how this should work with algorithms, right? And you go, okay, well, what would the definition of busy work be inside of a session? And what are we trying to do with the session? So if we look at a session as the number one limiter within a session is time.
Yeah.
We only have so much time. So we want to pick the most effective techniques given the amount of time we have. Great. Now we obviously have more time than we need to do one technique, right? And we all know that from the research, although somehow this idea of the one perfect technique always seems to seep back in somehow.
Yeah.
We know overall integrated interventions work. Well, how do we choose which techniques we're going to use? Well, we could prioritize those based on effect size. Right, so we want to use the most effective techniques, and then everything else gets parsed away. So when somebody comes to me with this idea of busy work, I know this was a very long way to get to this.
That's okay.
But when somebody comes to the idea of busy work, I'm like, okay, I follow you. You're saying that this is less effective and you don't want to do it, but here's what you haven't proven. Once again, going back to that default position fallacy, you haven't proven that you actually have a technique that's more effective than what you're dismissing.
Yeah.
Right? So if you think that rock tape is busy work and it's not effective, okay, what thing do you think we should be replacing rock tape with that's so much more effective we should dismiss rock tape here? Right?
Right.
And I would venture to guess that rock tape is not the most effective modality we have, but that doesn't mean it's not effective and we have to prioritize it accordingly.
Yeah.
You know?
And that gets into what are you using it for too, you know, like you said before. Well, so, and that.
Now we're back to the nuanced conclusion thing that I talked
exactly,
about.
Yeah.
Right. Which is going to affect effect size. If you try to generalize something, like say something like rock tape is effective, well, rock tape is effective, implying for everything, is going to result in a very low effect size, and in some cases, probably not show an effect size at all. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden, we start looking at rock tape, and the way we use it at the Brookbush Institute, right, is reinforcing activation techniques, right, to improve activity of underactive muscles, to try to improve carryover session to session. When you say all that, all of a sudden, rock tape becomes really, really effective because you've narrowed your scope to where rock tape has its best uses. And I'm not saying that's its only use, but that's how we use it. And we know that it has a really good effect size there. And the research supports that, right? Like we know that like the lower trap taping actually decreases upper trapezius activity. And that's what the research says, which is a little odd. It's just like, I was hoping for lower trap increase, but I'll take an upper trap decrease. It ends up doing the same thing. So
I want to activate this one. Nope, we're going to shut off somebody else.
That's a little weird, but that's what the research says, and it is effective. So,
yeah. I mean, it's a really good point, and I see this too with – I was like this as a student. I see this with my students as well too, is they get caught up in the fanciness of one technique. And, you know, I think sometimes you get laziness where it's like, this is a great technique. I don't want to learn anything else. I want to just really be good at this one. We start to fall into that rabbit hole of this is the only thing. And if it's not this thing, then why would I use it? I see that with a lot of methods and systems. And they're great. They're all great. But I think people get really focused on that as the only thing. And then it starts to lead into some of the stuff we were just talking about, is these bias. They're looking for research to disprove or prove certain things just because they want it to kind of back up. Like, this is my favorite thing, so I just want to focus on that.
Yeah. I mean, like, to give you a personal example, right? Like the cupping thing. I don't do it.
Yeah.
And people will be like, well, why don't you do it? Is it because you hate cupping? No, I've never done cupping. So they'll be like, so what's your opinion on cupping? And I'll be like, I don't have one. And that little statement, like, most people aren't willing to make.
Yeah.
You know, it's so silly, right? Like, they expect, because I don't use cupping, I should bash cupping.
Well, also that you have to have a reason.
Yeah, I don't use cupping because I'm busy doing all this other stuff, right? And I, you know, like, I use mobilizations and manipulations, static release techniques. Like, so, you know, at the Brookbush Institute, we teach, you know, release, mobilize, lengthen, isolated activation, integration, right? Mm-hmm. That's a tremendous number of techniques.
It's a lot.
And we also use taping and ISTM, right? To once again, to help with that carryover. Those are maybe lower effect size techniques, but they're definitely beneficial. So we have all of these techniques that we're working on, and I'm working on doing these lit reviews and working on making sure that we are creating, again, those nuanced conclusions for best use cases. And then you go to me and go, well, why don't you use cupping? It's like, do I sound like a guy who has a lot of free time on my hands at this point? I mean, will I get to cupping? Yeah, maybe. I mean, one of my former writers and friend, Nick, introduced me to BFR and the blood flow restriction stuff. And there's another technique I would love to add to the site. It took him a little while to convince me that I should use it, but I've used it and it is incredibly effective. Well, why is it on your site? Like I said, there's a lot of other stuff going on.
Yeah.
And that's okay. In your own practice, you can treat your own practice the same way we treat the Brookbush Institute. It's like, well, why aren't you cupping? Or why aren't you doing ISTM? Or why aren't you doing dry needling? Or why aren't you doing pin and stretch techniques? And you can just be like, I was working on my manipulations, or I was working on joint mobilizations, or I was working on, you know, static manual release techniques. Like, that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay to work and get better at one thing at a time. I think that's actually probably good practice, but integrate it into your full bag, and then don't be a jerk and dismiss stuff just because you haven't used it yourself.
And that's what you get a lot of from a lot of different levels. Oh, you don't do this. You must not be a good practitioner, right? It's like, well, but I've got a lot of other things on my plate, right? And guess what? I get my patients better. So, you know, you can say that, but it's extremely inaccurate and just downright rude. But it's like, you know, you can't learn every single technique. And I think if you do learn every single technique, let's hypothesize that that's possible. Are you really making your practice any better if you're just doing literally everything on somebody? So I think there's that focus is very important sometimes, yes, but just because you're not doing one particular thing doesn't mean you're doing anything that is not effective.
Right. And there are different models out there, right? So, you know, somebody asked me the other day, I go to a friend of mine for physical therapy and we do sessions, trade sessions. Now, she used to work for me a long time ago, so she knows our model, but she does not treat like I do.
Right.
Right. She actually is a fellow of the Institute of Physio Arts, right? Which is a different education company. And people will be like, well, why do you go to her for physical therapy? And I'll be like, because if my shit didn't work, why would I go to somebody, right, who treats exactly like I do?
Right.
And we all get into those positions where it's like, you know, I've been doing my stuff, I got myself 90% better, but for some reason, like, I'm missing something.
Right.
Right. There's other models out there that are going to work for that percentage of the population. You know, we've talked about this at the Brookbush Institute, where it's like, if my predictive models of postural dysfunction can create the most effective routines for 85% of the population, that's a win.
Yeah.
That's not a loss. And there'll be 15% of the population who either didn't get as good as they could have with another model, or maybe didn't get better at all. And people are like, yeah, you suck. See, that didn't work. You suck. And it's like, no, we're talking about probabilities here. You know, it's the I'm sure you guys talk about this in chiropractic school. It's like the other question that runs into this probability thing is like, have you ever flared up a patient?
Yeah.
If you say no, you are lying.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Okay, like, right. If you do therapy, there are going to be times where it's like you get that irritable patient and like you do that one thing and they are flared up. And that is part of practice. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you should never do that technique again?
No.
Absolutely not. It might have worked 19 out of 20 times.
Yeah.
But that one time, one person didn't get better. And people have a hard time, I think, with that little bit of this science too, is nothing is 100%.
Yeah, that's a big thing that I see a lot of, is the idea of, I'm just a baseball guy, so I use the baseball analogy, is like nobody hits 1,000. It's impossible. You just right. can't. And this, it's good analogy for rehab, because you're just never going to hit 1,000. It's situational. Everybody's physiology is a little bit different. Say whatever you want, but there's nothing out there that is 100% effective, and nobody should strive for that, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about the Holy Grail being the first time fixed to perfect every time.
Yeah.
Right, like that would be the Holy Grail for what we're going for. We're going to create the absolute perfect session. But all I have to do is mention something like grade 2 muscle strain, and that goes out the window, right? Like there's no way to fix a strain in one session, right? You have a tear. It's going to take 4 to 6 weeks just to start, you know, scarring down. And then you're going to have whatever compensation pattern that's left afterwards that you got to clean up.
Yeah.
You know, you got to understand a little bit of the chronicity of these things, but I think it's a good goal. I think it's always better to see how much of an effect size can you get in one session. And
yeah,
you know, I think my practice is a little interesting in that I usually only see people one to three times most.
Yeah.
And our focus is, you know, self-management, and most people don't come back that often, you know, just like everybody else, everybody gets hurt again eventually. But yeah.
I want to see you again, but for something else, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's what happens. Or they see you for the same thing because they have a flare up 2 years later after they've stopped doing their therapeutic exercise like they should, and they got deconditioned or whatever. But
right.
It's a good Holy Grail, but you gotta keep the science in check.
Yeah.
It's tough, man. We don't teach this stuff right in school.
I totally agree. And I say to my students all the time, like I will use an example and I'll be demonstrating a certain technique and like, oh, hamstring muscle length got really dramatically better. Awesome. Cool. But then I have to go into the explanation, like situationally, maybe I picked the right person. Maybe I just use the right technique for this situation at a time. He might get up, walk around, and all of a sudden it goes back to where it was. I did one thing off of one stuff. It doesn't mean that that's all he needs. And honestly, if I get someone 100% the first time I work with them, I am a little skeptical, because it's like, I should be doing that every single time. When someone right. gets 75 to 85% better when they're walking out my door, then I'm like, I made a lot of really good progress. But if they get 100% better, I should be like, you got to do that every single time. And then I'm just going to break myself down as a practitioner.
Yeah. I mean, the hard thing that comes in with trying to get to that 100%, again, goes back to that information problem I was talking about, that algorithmic problem, right? So if you want to get everybody 100% better, you're not going to do the same technique for everybody. Then the question becomes, well, how are you going to choose your techniques? And that's where things start getting more and more complicated, right? Because then you have to talk about, well, what is the perfect movement assessment? And what is that based on? And how do you balance differential versus inferential reasoning, right? Like, right. What is your reliability? What, you know, all those wonderful statistical terms that we hate, like specificity and sensitivity, and, you know, all of that comes in to how do we get to as close to batting 1,000 as we possibly can. Like,
yeah.
I think we can get closer than we are. I think we're, as a profession, better than we've ever been. It's just a little interesting, some of the stuff that social media, I think more than anything, is pumped with these like very controversial things that aren't helping us move forward, right? And mm-hmm. a lot of it, like you said, is coming, you know, we have these misinterpretations of research. You know, the one that I hate the most to see right now is which we didn't even talk about, but is people have this tendency now to, even the most well-respected educators are basically cherry-picking retrospective systematic reviews and using the failure to refute the null hypothesis as proof of something, which is like a whole bevy of horrible things, right? You know, cherry-picking is bad. Retrospective systematic reviews are secondary sources, not original data. Mm-hmm. The null hypothesis is the nothing hypothesis, so refuting it doesn't mean a damn thing. And if we're going to refute the null hypothesis in a systematic review, it's just as likely that we have hypothesis generation errors, regression to the mean, insufficient research to actually do a systematic review with that statistical tool, as it would be for a systematic review to actually tell us that this particular technique is ineffective. That's actually probably the least likely in these retrospective systematic reviews. We got to get away from all that. We got to get back to the scientific method.
Yeah.
Take everything as a probability. Take everything as a data point. Slowly refine your practice.
Explain the null hypothesis a little bit, just for anybody who's heard of it, but maybe isn't super familiar with exactly its definition.
Yeah. So the null hypothesis, when you're setting up a research study, and this is part of the problem with systematic reviews, is they're not research studies. So there shouldn't be a null hypothesis. But a null hypothesis when you're setting up an experimental study is, or even an observational study, is basically saying, here would be the hypothesis of no effect, right? And you're trying to set up a base to test change against, right? So if there's no change, you had nothing. It doesn't mean anything, though, because it's nothing, right? So if we test, you know, what is the effectiveness of cervical manipulations, we have to pick an outcome measure. All right, so let's pick goniometry. So we pick lateral flexion, cervical goniometry, measuring the effectiveness of cervical manipulations, and we don't reach a statistically significant point. Mm-hmm. Well, the truth of the matter is that research study didn't actually tell us anything because we just got back to baseline.
Right.
And that baseline also includes all of the potential confounding variables, right? So cervical manipulation didn't cause a range of motion change using goniometry. Now we're left with the question of why.
Sure.
It's not actually saying that cervical manipulations, that particular study, which I'm totally making up, would not actually tell us that cervical manipulations are ineffective. It's just kind of going, nah, that didn't work.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's try something different. You can kind of understand why now when I said like using the null hypothesis as proof of anything is very, very, very problematic.
Yeah.
You would have to have, in order to like prove a negative, which is absolutely possible, that's a myth that you can't prove a negative, but in order to like use the null hypothesis as evidence, you would more likely need to see multiple studies with multiple populations using multiple different outcome measures continually showing no change to take the null hypothesis as proof, right? Like you'd have to start dialing in on, okay, no matter what we do, this doesn't seem to have an effect. Now you can start leaning to this doesn't have an effect.
That makes a lot of sense too, because I think that's something that we go back to the bias we've talked about is, well, it didn't work. And it's, I mean, just,
has anybody noticed that like every systematic review says nothing works? And like the thing that flips me out with that is most of these systematic reviews are really bad. Ioannidis actually published a paper not too long ago. Depending on who you ask, not too long ago, about only 3% of systematic reviews are actually beneficial and useful.
Wow.
In medicine. And, you know, I think the reason why you see all of these systematic reviews not showing any change is because they're just not done properly, or they're not the systematic review that should have been done at all. Right. There's not enough research in that area. Somebody tried to prove something, which happens way too often. They like start with a null hypothesis for a systematic review. That doesn't actually make any sense. You're not doing an experiment. You're gathering data. Mm-hmm. So just gather the frickin' data and tell us what it says. don't set out to prove something. Now you're just confirmation bias all over the place, right? That's right. A hypothesis generation error, an author bias error. Yeah, man, the drama that is systematic reviews right now is pretty miserable.
Do you think people jump on that because it's almost convenient to be like, you know, this is going to gather all the evidence for me and I'll just pay attention to that. And then you just noticed, then you just pointed out rather how the errors that can come with that.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to everything we've been saying, right? Confirmation bias, excuse driven therapy, complacency, like let me find this thing that shoots something down that now I don't have to learn. I don't have to practice because boom, I have the systematic review. And it leads into this other fallacy that's being taught again, like new is better, which is these hierarchies of evidence, mm-hmm. but they're not getting, you know, you guys know levels of evidence, right?
Yeah.
So these levels of evidence aren't getting taught properly, right? They teach that systematic reviews are the best evidence. Well, it's not exactly true. When you look at these hierarchies and you start looking at different hierarchies, you start realizing that what would be the highest quality evidence would be something like a prospective, right? Meta-analysis of RCTs or multi-armed RCTs. But that changes the dynamic, right? When you say prospective, you're purposely constructing a set of studies in advance to come to the most accurate conclusion that can be come to. You're not coming to a conclusion here. Whereas retrospect, right? Like retrospect, we can manipulate the data however we want.
Mm, yeah.
Prospective, you are a slave to the experiment, which is how it should be. Right? So if we somehow put prospective reviews, those would be at the top. And then of course we have our experimental studies and then observational research. And then below that is case studies and opinions. But you also have to look at, well, what is the levels of evidence based on? And I've asked this question to so many people and nobody knows. I'm like, so tell me, why is level one better than level two? Why is level two better than level three? Oh, because you know, it's like better research. That's not an answer. That's a subjective, arbitrary opinion on research.
Yeah.
Can you honestly tell me why an RCT is better than an observational study? Well, yeah. Right? Like, and what it all comes down to is the potential for bias and error. Right? So if we have prospective meta-analysis at the very top, which frankly does not happen in rehab, so stop even bringing it up. We just, you know, the only time you see that stuff is like with the vaccine, right? The vaccine would be a perfect example where, you know, big pharma, they have the money and they are expected to do that level of evidence to get anything actually through, right? So it's given to the public. We're not big pharma. We don't have millions or billions or whatever the amount of money it would take to like do something like that. Right. So let's move down to RCTs, right? So we have RCTs, observational studies. Okay. What are we talking about here? We're talking about percent bias or the chance of bias and error. Remember, we are talking about probabilities. So right off the bat, when I said chance, you should have been thinking, well, you have a chance that level two is biased or it's not. And you have a chance that level three is biased or it's not, right? And considering we have a peer review process and we're talking about usually original research published in peer-reviewed journals, you know, you got to think that most of this research being published is probably not biased. Mm. I would hope, right? Unless you are a total pessimist. But at the very least, you can't say that level two dismisses level three. Mm. It's just a probability. So if we say that, like, for example, level two has a 10% risk of bias and error and level three has a 15% risk of bias and error, we could weight those differently, but one can't dismiss the other. They both have a chance. Not to mention that RCTs and observational studies don't research the same thing. But, you know, that would be way too much to ask to go back to your introduction to research methods and remember that some things can actually be researched with experiments and some can't.
Yeah.
but you know, you start thinking about if we took like a Bayesian approach to this whole thing, which is we could set a weighting in advance, right? Consider all of the research, and maybe you give RCTs a higher weight than prospective and observational studies, and then allow that to weight your opinion at the end when you consider all of them. At no point can you wave around an RCT and go, this, for example, if I had, which this happens often, if I had 12 RCTs and 135 level 3 studies, are you going to really tell me that those 12 RCTs are worth more than the 135 observational studies?
Right.
I don't. And then you have one systematic review that happens to be retrospective. Like, the hierarchies were never built to do that. That was not the thing. I mean, you if you're going to dismiss research, number one, the line would be between levels 3 and 4, right? We lose the power of statistics when we go from observational research to case studies.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. But above that, you know, level 2 and 3 is good to go. Level 1 just doesn't happen, you know, from our perspective. Systematic reviews, like they're done in our industry, are retrospective and secondary sources, and they're actually not part of the hierarchy. It's like trying to put a textbook in the hierarchy. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And I think one of the biggest things that might need to be kind of implemented is just, you know, a little bit more education on how to look at research, I think, if I can say that. I know myself, that's one thing I try to be better at, is being able to look at research and appreciate it. One of the things I just tell myself is if I'm reading one particular study, I'm just taking it for what that study says, but I'm not making those definitive conclusions from it, you know?
Right.
I find it interesting to read about the studies and research that's being done out there too. But yeah, then when we plug it into practice without really thinking about it, sometimes it gets us into that kind of trouble and contentious debates that we see on social media so often, right?
Yeah. I mean, to your point, like if you, like one study, like I use the analogy of pointillism. Have you ever seen this painting where it's like, it's just dots? Right?
No.
There's a, what is it called? I'm like forgetting all these names. I feel like I need more coffee today.
You always need more coffee.
It's like, yeah, always. It's like afternoon on the River Ganges or something like that. And okay. You get Sorrow. And you look back and it looks like this like really pretty, but kind of misty looking picture. It's like not perfectly clear. It like kind of has like a haze to it. But then when you get up, you realize the whole thing has been dots.
Is that
right?
Is that a classic painting?
Yes.
Is that the one they used in Ferris Bueller? They did the like zoom in, like Cameron's just staring at it, and they like zoom in, and it shows the dots.
It might be. It wouldn't surprise me.
Now, but I gotta look this up.
We gotta look all this stuff up and like go back and correct all of this stuff that we did wrong. Einstein's publication, Sherrington's Nobel.
It's like
anyway. Yeah. So. If you looked at the research studies themselves, though, as one dot, I think you have a better interpretation of what's going on, right? Like, you don't have a full picture.
Right.
There's another quote I love, which is, science is the slow march of accumulating evidence. If you see opinions bouncing around and changing all the time, that's because somebody isn't looking at all the research. Hmm. The body of research does not change. Right? This whole idea that like, oh, information changes and science changes so fast. In our industry. No, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. Stop. If you think the science in our industry is changing fast, you don't read. Well, you don't read research. You might be reading something, but you're like, manipulations are still effective. Dry needling is still effective. Therapeutic exercise is still effective. Therapeutic and corrective exercise is still effective. Foam rolling is very effective. None of this stuff has changed.
Yeah.
Like the human body is essentially the same as it was, I don't know, for how many centuries or millennia or whatever. Like,
right. Nobody's growing new arms.
Yeah. That would be interesting. If we had more arms, what would that do to scapular mechanics? Question of the day.
That could be, we should do a thought experiment as an entire podcast, is what would happen to scapular mechanics if you had two arms on the same side?
We could do like some sort of like Avengers superhero mechanics analysis.
Wow. Dude, don't give me podcast ideas. You and I don't have the time because this would be so much fun.
Based on the Hulk squat, I think.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Based on the way Captain America holds his head, I think
the physics of that freaking frisbee that he throws around.
Right. Why does he still have fingers? That would be my first question. But yeah, obviously that's not going to work out. Talk about Iron Man and like concussions.
Oh my God.
Like, every time he stops, like that's it.
There are actually plenty of books out there, like The Science of Comic Books and stuff like that. Pretty fascinating stuff. But
yeah,
let's wrap this up. This was a great conversation. I always learn something talking to you, Brent. And honestly, if you're not following Brent at Brookbush Institute on Instagram, you really should, because the posts are extremely informative. He goes like, you know, this is multiple pictures, slides, a lot of good reading, and definitely go to brickbushinstitute.com because for a monthly fee, you get full access to everything that's on there, which includes 3 certifications. And what do you usually say? How many hours of content do you have up there? If you could put a number to it.
Oh, so we have like over 150 courses, which probably means there's like 400 plus credits available. Right. CEC credits. We have enough to keep you recertified and relicensed.
That's plenty. Yeah.
Like there's no doubt about that. And it's all for like a Netflix style membership. Like it's $19.99 a month. The fact that we're making this work, it's the way education should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to march forward towards including a degree program in that same, you know, app based, you can be on desktop or your app, like for $19.99 a month. I mean, look at all the research stuff we talked about aside, I hope people realize like what we provide as a service. Like I'm dedicated to optimizing education in our industry. It is obviously in bad need of help.
Right.
And part of that of course is affordability and accessibility and all that fun stuff. So I appreciate you having me on and getting the chance to rap about all this stuff and
get the time. Yeah, man. Like I said, the Brookbush Institute, I use it myself. I actually use it in one of my rehab classes as a virtual textbook, and I get at least a handful of students every term saying, thank you for using this. I appreciate it too. And I got a lot of students that tell me they maintain the membership because you can go on it whenever you want and use it. So I will tout this until the end of time. This is a fantastic model. And you guys should definitely be checking that out. Check out the Instagram page. You only primarily use Instagram, right?
No. We're big on Facebook, LinkedIn, okay. YouTube. We post on Twitter, although I kind of hate Twitter because it's like...
Yeah, I got off of Twitter a long time ago.
But if you're on Twitter, like we still post everything. We post everything on every platform.
Right.
It doesn't really matter where you are. Lately, my favorite's been LinkedIn. Honestly, LinkedIn is the most positive of the platforms, which is just kind of refreshing.
Yeah.
It's nice to see colleagues helping colleagues and not talk about random trolling junk.
That's a good place to end it. Yeah. Random trolling junk. Brent, thanks so much for being here, man. I appreciate it.
Until next time, the squat of the Hulk.
The squat of the Hulk.